I'd like to, before I introduce you to today's guest, I just want to share some information with you. According to a new study conducted by the American Bar Association, together with the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation, lawyers struggle with substance abuse, particularly drinking, and with depression and anxiety more commonly than some other professionals. In fact, what they found was that 1 in 3 practicing lawyers are problem drinkers, which is a pretty high number. Problem drinking by lawyers was notably higher than the 15% of surgeons who were characterized as abusing alcohol. So, good news, bad news, or actually not good news anywhere. Clearly, what we have in terms of folks in these kinds of high-stress professions is an ability to use and overuse substances, perhaps as a way to get through the day, the hour, the connection, the job, the program. With that, I would like to introduce you to the author of Girl Walks Out of a Bar, Lisa F. Smith. Lisa has been very much a part of a legal life, if you will, for a while. Prior to her 15-year legal marketing career, Lisa practiced corporate law. Lisa F. Smith, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, Lisa, tell us what legal marketing means.
Legal marketing is working with the partners in a law firm to help to grow the business. And I came to it as a lawyer in the corporate finance group of a major international law firm that was based in New York City. And after 5.5 years of practice of a very intense, that kind of 80-hour work week, round-the-clock practice, I was also drinking very heavily and really kind of needed to switch up what I was doing because I wasn't going to be able to continue both drinking and practicing at the level I was at. And I had an opportunity to stay at the firm that I was at. I was somehow managing to do well despite how much I was drinking, and I liked the idea of legal marketing as something to go into to jump over to the administrative side of the law firm in order to not have those constant pressures of the practicing attorney.
Although, I mean, certainly corporate law and on the financial end, it's easy to understand that that would be quite stressful, but working with partners to grow the firm, was that less stressful?
In fact, yes, it was. I was very much concerned working the kinds of things that I was working on, and I think a lot of young lawyers work on. They're very detailed, minute, and even the smallest thing can lead to significant consequences for how a transaction is completed or what happens with a client's case. And if something goes wrong on that end, there's a serious problem on the hands of the lawyer and the partner they work for and the firm and potentially the client. On the marketing side, even though it was still an intense environment of working under pressure with partners, nobody's going to blow up a deal if we get something wrong in marketing. Nobody is going to risk having a regulator in D.C. come after them on some kind of transaction because something went wrong in marketing. The stakes are just lower.
Interesting. Are you still doing that work?
I actually did that work consistently throughout from 1996, actually, when I switched over from practicing. And I've done it throughout and stayed in big law firms. And now I am at a firm in New York City where I spent 9 years as the marketing director, the director of marketing, working with partners and overseeing that function here. And for the last 2.5, almost 3 years, I have been the deputy executive director of the firm. So I actually have broader responsibility now beyond marketing that covers things like legal hiring and things like the library resources, the ways we serve our clients in order to provide the best client service we can.
Well, you likely heard my introduction in which I talked about the incidence of substance use and abuse among those in the legal profession. Did those numbers surprise you, or did they seem too low or spot on?
The numbers did surprise me. Before this study, this was really the first major study to be conducted in about 25 years. And in the past, I knew that the number was around, estimated to be around 1 in 5, maybe even a little less rosy than that. But this study really, I think it may be that people were more honest this time around. They're more forthcoming, but it's a really high number. It is more, the average population is estimated to have a substance abuse problem somewhere in the range of 9%. And, you know, for lawyers in some categories to have possibly over 30%, and as an overall, you know, something that approaches that is definitely surprising and upsetting, I think. It's a sad thing for the profession. What was most surprising to me, actually, about the survey results was that the highest incidence of problem drinking is among lawyers who are in their first 10 years of practice. So lawyers in the 1 to 10-year range had the highest, over 30% of an incidence of substance abuse. And I have always thought of alcoholism as a progressive disease, that at least that's the way it was for me over the years that I drank, and my drinking got steadily worse. I was much worse in my late 30s than I was in my early to mid 20s when I got out of law school. So that, to me, was something I didn't expect. And I think that's an important statistic to pay attention to for law firms, for the industry, for law schools.
Do you think, I mean, this is somewhat of an aside, but can you imagine a time when law firms will require less than 60 to 80 hours a week of their folks?
Yes, I definitely do. And I think that it is probably in many cases not as bad now as it was when I was practicing, in certain ways, but in certain ways it's a 24/7 practice now. When I was practicing, we were in the office for up to 80 hours or so a week, but when we left the office, we left the office. Unless someone called on the home phone, we weren't walking around with our cell phones and our email with us 24/7.
Gotcha.
Now, for lawyers, you might be in the office for far fewer hours, but that doesn't mean you're not on call, paying attention to your email, always connected. So in a way, I think it can be considered even harder. Maybe you get to do some of that work at home, but you're where you were done when you left, now you are always available in the client service driven industry.
It's interesting. And if you have a client who is particularly anxious for any number of reasons, that's going to add to your anxiety as the attorney.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And these are, depending on what kind of law you practice, if you're in, you know, my experience is really limited to large firms. A lot of lawyers go into all different areas of the law and practice in, they might practice in government or in smaller firms or on their own or in-house at a company. And the pressures may be different, but the pressures are still really significant. And as you said, if you have clients who are very focused, intense, if this is their business that's on the line with whatever matter you're working on, they're going to be extremely demanding, and that does carry over to the lawyer.
Makes sense. Now, you begin Girl Walks Out of the Bar with a description of essentially living in a world of alcohol, cocaine, cigarettes. I mean, it was just, and this was it early in the morning. This
yeah.
kind of behavior had already begun. And you say that you had resigned yourself simply to being an alcohol and cocaine addict. That's how you saw your future. But I'd like to back up a bit and hear more about your childhood. What was your childhood like?
My childhood actually was, I grew up in suburban New Jersey, about a half an hour outside of New York City. And I grew up in a happy home. I lived with both my parents and my brother, who's 2 years younger. And I didn't have any of, we frequently associate people who fall into addiction as having had traumas in their upbringing or something, experiencing something difficult as children. I never had that happen, and I have tried to find and dig back if there are things that I've somehow decided to block in my memory and have never been successful in those efforts. But what I did have was, for as long as I can remember, sort of this underlying sadness and anxiety generally. That was, you know, some of my earliest memories are running down the hallway in my parents' house to try to get to their room after I'd had a horrible nightmare. I had regular night terrors as a kid. I never really felt like I fit in entirely. I was a poor athlete, which didn't help. I found a lot of comfort and some relief from that chronic kind of anxiety and feeling like I wasn't like everybody else through food initially. I was a sneaky eater, and I loved sweets, and I would sort of shovel that, and I didn't realize I was getting a big hit of dopamine in doing that, but it gave me relief, and that led me to become overweight, which led to worse sort of teasing at school and spiraled the problem that I had internally. And by the time I was, as soon as I found kids who were drinking in high school by, 13 years old or so, I was right there with them. And once I found alcohol, it made me more comfortable in my own skin.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about the fact that at some point in your childhood, having a tub of ice cream was calming, and I quote you, "the closest I ever came to happy." I'm wondering if you have any sense that the adults around you had an inkling of the sadness that you sort of generically carried, it almost sounds like.
I think that there was some of that. I know that my mother was, she was very loving and really saw that I was unhappy a lot of the time and would always try to do things to fix it, give me pep talks if I wanted to try and focus on my weight to try and help me eat healthier. It didn't really work so well, and it was a time where I grew up in the 70s, so it wasn't a time where she would say, Lisa seems to be struggling emotionally. I hid what I could, but I certainly couldn't hide everything. And I think if it had been a time where people took their kids, to go get some mental health help, I think she would have done that. I think she would have. I think if I was growing up sort of with the discomfort and unease that I did today, that she would have found that there were, it was much more common to reach out for some help than it was in, say, 1976.
Much more common and a lot more okay than it
yes.
was then.
Yeah.
You say that you began taking sort of snips of alcohol from the adults around you at the age of 8. Do you remember the first time you experienced alcohol? I mean, 8 is, you're such a tiny person in so many ways at 8 years old.
I know. Well, it was never, there was never any taboo around alcohol. So
Okay.
the times that I, when I sort of would steal these kind of sips and play with it a little bit, were at parties that my parents would throw. So my parents were social drinkers, but regular drinkers. It was very much a alcohol was always around in the house, but not in any way that was scary or abusive or anything like that. They would have together, my dad was a judge, and when he would come home at the end of the day, he and my mother would have their cocktail hour. They would, it was very much around the ritual of it. You know, the rocks glasses with the scotch and the cheese, the Jarlsberg cheese on a platter with crackers, and they would toast to good health, and they would have one drink, maybe two, and that was it. So I didn't see abuse. I saw it as something that they very much enjoyed doing at the end of each day. And alcohol looked like a happy thing to me. And at these big parties that they would throw when their friends came over, who were from all kinds of all different walks of life, and there were these big happy parties, there weren't people passing out or throwing up or yelling at each other. There was never anything bad associated with alcohol. It just seemed to make the adults happier and friendlier. And so as a kid, I couldn't wait to grow up and check it out. And even as a kid, I was very curious about what it tasted like, what it felt like. I was always looking at these drinks. And so I have very clear images of being, I don't know which one was the first one, but of being at parties where, you know, there's that drink sitting there somewhere, there's no one around in the room, and you know, just taking tastes and realizing pretty quickly, because you're, as you said, you're so small, that it could have a pretty profound impact on me in terms of, there it is, I feel better.
So it was a combination, I would think, of being a grown up and being a happy grown up that
Yes,
sort of
very
drove
much.
the behavior. So at 8, you
Yeah.
were tasting. By 10, you describe yourself as catching a buzz. This is 10
Yes.
years old.
Yeah.
And by
Yeah.
12, 13, almost all your friends were drinkers.
And I should say that because I found the kids who like to drink.
Well, yeah.
So yeah. Yeah, that was the kind of time that we would be, you know, sort of pinching beers from our parents' refrigerators and going out into the woods behind the school and smoking cigarettes and drinking beers. That was sort of that phase. And then there would be, you know, by the time, certainly by, you know, mid-teens, where we would congregate in somebody's basement, where the parents weren't home or something like that. And by then there were certainly older siblings, and the drinking age was only 18, so it was easy for people in high school to get alcohol. So that was sort of the next level.
And I would suggest that at that time, the idea that a parent would think about their child as having a drinking problem, I'm not sure that was even part of sort of the social awareness.
I think that's right. I know that for me, I used to hear a lot because, you know, there were times that I got caught, you know, either kind of drunk or more common, my mother would find my cigarettes or something like that. But the thought was always, well, she's getting all A's in school. There's no, you know, there can't be a problem here.
Right.
And that I think, you know, plays throughout, even when, you know, it was not, I was frequently the most drunk person at events. I frequently drank the most, but, you know, anybody who was around me, I was still doing well. So what could possibly be wrong? I think that that was the prevailing attitude. And I think that is beginning to change, if it hasn't changed already, that, you know, there's the realization that you can be performing just fine wherever you're supposed to show up on a given day, but that doesn't mean that there's not something going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. Lisa, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want you to tell us the story about your bat mitzvah. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Lisa, a bat mitzvah is a pretty important time in a young girl's life. For those who aren't aware, explain what a bat mitzvah is and its importance.
Sure. A bat mitzvah is something that Jewish girls, it's the equivalent of a Jewish boy's bar mitzvah, which is where at the age of 13, you are considered to become a man or a woman, and sort of crossing into adulthood, and there is a service around it, and there's a lot of education that goes into it because there are parts of it in Hebrew, and I won't get into the whole background behind it, but it is a pretty serious and yet celebratory ritual in the Jewish religion, and I had gone to Hebrew school and to, to the equivalent of Sunday school to learn all about culture and learn Hebrew and do all of that from the time that I was about 8 years old, I think that started, which culminated in this bat mitzvah on a Saturday morning. My 13th birthday was in 1979 and in February, so very cold out kind of time, and it's a morning thing, a morning celebration at the temple, and the bat mitzvah, which was me, takes part in the service with the rabbi and the cantor, and after the service, then we had, I think today people do these elaborate nighttime parties and very fancy things, but at the time, we did a luncheon, which was in the back. The temple had a party room, and family, friends. It's the closest. It's almost like a mini wedding kind of thing. And I had a lot of my friends there, and tons of family and my parents' friends and all there. And one of the boys, we were in seventh grade, 13, and one of the boys managed to heist a bottle of Jack Daniels from the bar, I guess when the bartender had stepped away, and taken it outside in the back in the parking lot of the temple. And so kids were sneaking out and gathering around and doing shots off this bottle of Jack Daniels, and I certainly was compelled to join them and snuck out as much as I could from the party and tried to disguise it with Tic Tacs, which seemed to work. Everybody else was in a celebratory mood. We weren't being looked at in any particular way. And that was the bottle of Jack Daniels at my bat mitzvah.
And, Jack Daniels, it's kind of a significant drink. I mean, it's not like you were having, wine spritzers or coolers or something. This was some serious business. There's a lot of study that goes into preparing for a bat mitzvah. How did you navigate that and your drinking? Or did you give yourself sort of drinking holidays during that time?
Oh, well, at that age, it was really a treat to be able to get alone and drink. That was sort of the weekend thing. I was not drinking a lot at that point. I was drinking when I could binge drink with my friends, which was strictly limited to the weekend. So it really didn't play a role in, I didn't become a daily drinker until I started practicing law, although I would be hard-pressed to think of a whole lot of nights in college that I didn't have a drink.
Well, you also describe yourself by 15 as being the binge drinker on the weekend, smoking pot, doing cocaine. When you say binge drinking, that means different things to different people. What did it mean to you? Was that 2 drinks, 20 drinks, 200 drinks?
To me, it meant enough drinks to get drunk.
Okay.
So I would say, on a Friday night or a Saturday night that we were all hanging out on the weekends, I would not have drank less than a six-pack. And that was probably somewhere around the range of where I'm trying to think of the way we bought or the orders we placed of how we would allocate. But we also drank a lot of cheap Rioniti wine. And so that was sort of harder to track how much. But I would say, easy 6 drinks and then, maybe some drugs. Hopefully some drugs if we were lucky.
How were you getting that?
Oh, it was easy then. Like I said, the drinking age was 18. So our friends, there were older siblings who would always buy for us.
Okay.
And we all had fake IDs. We had paper licenses back then. And one of my skills at the time in high school was being able to do a really good doctoring job on a paper driver's license to create a fake ID.
So you must have been very popular.
I was, yeah. Those services were called upon many times.
I can't imagine.
I worked magic with the razor blade and the paper license.
Now,
I think it's much harder to say.
Just a hair, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sort of hesitating because I'm imagining this, 15-year-old girl, she's binge drinking on the weekend, she's doing drugs, she's drinking, she's just literally having a personal party on the weekends, and yet you were still a straight-A student, you were editor of the high school yearbook, you got accepted into Northwestern early. How did you do all of this? And you describe yourself as being a blackout drunk during those times.
Yeah, I had my first blackouts in high school, for sure. There were a lot of times that, not remembering coming home, not remembering who drove home, not remembering the end of the evening. I guess when you're young, I was under my parents' roof, so I was not, behaving like that during the school week. And also, I think the relief that I got on the weekend, held me a little bit, like kept me okay for the week. I was the kind of kid who immediately was looking forward to Friday because of drinking. The way I sometimes talk about it is that, a lot of people go to parties to socialize and they'll have a few drinks when they're there because people drink at parties. But for me, it was like I was going to drink and there happened to be humans in the room. Like,
gotcha.
It was, even by then, even from a very young age, the way I used to obsess about food, I began to obsess about alcohol. But I was able to, and I think maybe it's just a factor of the disease not having progressed fully at that point, it wasn't a problem to not be drinking during the week, although I did smoke pot during the week.
Did your parents, you said earlier that at the point that almost all of your friends were drinkers, it was because you sought them out, which makes sense. Did your parents notice a change in your friendships?
I don't think so, because they really... I shouldn't say that, because now that thinking about that, there were a group of girls that I had been very friendly with that I stopped being as friendly with. And they were much more kind of bookish, and they were into sports. So when I stopped being as friendly with them, I think it was pretty easily explainable that you know, I wasn't an athlete, and I wasn't going to be hanging around with the girls who were doing sports and into that. That I was more with the girls who went to the mall and hung around. So it was a fairly natural break, actually.
It sounds like it. During those times, as you were growing up, was there a social sense of what a drinker or problem drinker or an alcoholic looked like?
You know, there were some extreme examples, right? We used to use the term burnout for the kids who were always high or on drugs and not doing well in school and, you know, sort of considered trouble. And that wasn't my crowd. So there were distinctions. I mean, there was no question that the kids I hung around with were kids who drank and such, but as opposed to being the athletes. But we all did well in school, and we all were, you know, pretty normally socially engaged. I think that the attention in terms of drugs and alcohol was strictly focused on those kids who really seemed to be, you know, over a line and not functioning and not able to function in the normal sort of high school achievement way.
So you were really able, you and your friends, you were just able to sort of stay under the radar and continue to engage in the activities that, as you described them, that you really found relieving and happy time during the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
As you got out of high school and then moved into college, what happened with your drinking behavior?
It definitely escalated. Because then there was the freedom to, you know, not be at my parents. And there was always somebody to find to drink with. So I drank a lot more frequently. I drank to blackout a lot more frequently. There were a lot fewer drugs at Northwestern than there were in high school. And I think, you know, it's funny because we noticed, some of my friends and I would notice, that the kids who never experimented with drugs in high school went absolutely nuts and over the edge when they were let loose in college. And I think because there was no mystery in it to me, you know, if they were around, it was great, but alcohol was always my first love. The drugs were not nearly as prevalent in the places that I went. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where if you wanted to have happy hour and start drinking early, you could. And if you wanted to start drinking late, there was always a party. And if you didn't want to drink at all, you could do that too. I generally did not pick that third option.
Gotcha. There was no pressure to drink, sounds like, is what you're saying.
If there was, I was applying the pressure to, you know, I hate to say it, but I was probably one of the kids who was applying pressure, as opposed to be perfectly honest, then no one ever had to pressure me to drink. I was always ready to go.
Gotcha. How were your grades in college?
They were good. They were good. I actually was the president of the Political Science Honor Society. I double majored in political science and urban studies. And, you know, I loved school. You know, that's another piece of it, is that, you know, it wasn't like studying and reading for me was a chore or I was turned off from it. I enjoyed school, so I was happy to do the work and to do the school part. I loved going out and blowing off steam and getting relief later, but it didn't diminish my desire to want to do well in school and really learn. I've always really liked school.
So it sounds like from the outside looking in, you were the ideal student, the ideal daughter, the ideal friend.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When did you first take a stab at stopping the drinking?
I really tried to. I mean, I knew I was an alcoholic 10 years before I got sober. I was drinking every night at that point. So this is in probably about 1990, in the early 90s, at some point in there. I had been at my law firm and transferred into a department just based on the needs of the law firm, into the corporate finance department, where they needed people to practice out. And I had originally joined the firm as an environmental law attorney. I wanted to do environmental law and then hopefully move on to practice at the NRDC or another nonprofit to help promote environmental causes. And just based on business needs, very shortly into my time at the firm, several of us were shifted over one night from the environmental group to become corporate finance lawyers. And when that happened to me, I really, just based on my own internal, the voice in my head that speaks to me and tells me I'm not smart enough, I'm not good enough, I'm going to fail, I'm going to be discovered as a fraud, that voice just got turned, the volume got turned all the way up on that voice when I got switched. And I was sure I was not going to be able to handle life as a corporate lawyer.
And in fact, what you did, you tried to get them to withdraw the opportunity, as they described it.
I did. And they were very honest with me that there was not enough work in the environmental group. And that if I, and really I had only been practicing 6 months, so I didn't have options to go somewhere else at that point. I also had an expensive lease in New York and had started, living the life of a lawyer in New York and had expenses. So I think, all of it together, they the business needs of the firm came first, and I just started drinking every night. And there came a time where I said to myself that, okay, I've been drinking every night. I don't want to drink tonight. And at that point, I was going to different wine stores around different neighborhoods so that, no one wine store would see me in there every night and think I was an alcoholic. I said, today is a day I don't want to drink. If I drink today, if I have to go to the liquor store at the end of the day and buy a bottle of wine, then I am an alcoholic. And that night I had to go to the liquor store and buy a bottle of wine. And I said, okay, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm a high functioning alcoholic. And this is just what it's going to be. I'm not going to quit. I don't want to quit. I'm going to learn how to live as a high functioning alcoholic. And I did crazy things. It makes you think and do really, I stopped contributing to my 401k plan in the office because I was sure I would be dead by the time I was 40 as an alcoholic. So why would I be putting money away for when I was 65? It wasn't like I was ever going to be that age. So I started to adjust my life in ways to accommodate that. And one way being moving into marketing.
Gotcha. Okay. So, I mean, given that you saw yourself in a much shortened lifespan than certainly your parents would have hoped for you, and you began to craft your life around that, there was still a time when you wound up at Gracie Square. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to tell us what that experience was like, because it seemed like it was very, the reality of it was very different from what you had anticipated.
Yeah.
Folks, don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment to continue the conversation with Lisa F. Smith, author of Girl Walks Out of a Bar. We'll be right back. Lisa, tell us what Gracie Square was in your entree into that facility.
Sure. Gracie Square is a psychiatric hospital in Manhattan. It is where I went the day I finally decided to ask for help. At that point, I was 10 years into real addiction and had been going through the worst of it, which was the final year and a half. I had started using cocaine every day as a way to keep functioning and keep going with alcohol. I was not using it as a party drug. And a year and a half of living like that 24/7 with alcohol and cocaine got me to a place where I was physically in very bad shape. I was throwing up blood. I was bruised all over. There were other things going on. And emotionally, I was just gone. There wasn't anything left. And I finally decided to ask for help, that I couldn't go on like this anymore. And I knew I was afraid that day that I was going to die. And I decided that day that I didn't want to die. And I knew because of how far gone I was physically, I was going to need a hospitalized, medicated detox. And so I called my doctor and asked him where I should go for that. And I said I wanted to stay in Manhattan. I was not committing. I would only leave work at my law firm for the week for 5 days to go get medically straightened out and then go right back to work. And he gave me two possible detoxes. One was in Hell's Kitchen in New York City. And I said, not that neighborhood. I'm not going into a detox in Hell's Kitchen. And then the other option he gave me was Gracie Square, which was on the Upper East Side and sounded like Gracie Mansion, where the mayor lives. And I thought, that sounds like a really nice place. I'm gonna go to Gracie Square. So I signed myself in. I had to agree to a 72-hour psych hold in order to be treated. And I spent 5 days there. I wanted to leave immediately, but when I couldn't, I ended up relenting and spending 5 days there having a detox treatment.
At the end of those 5 days, did you return to work?
I did. I had... And this is where, you know, I really feel like everything with the book is why it's so important to me. It was strongly recommended that I go from Gracie Square to at least 28-day facility rehab, a true rehab, not just dealing with the physical stuff, but to go try and learn how to be sober for at least that time period, if not longer. And it was kind of assumed that I would do that, and I refused because that would have required going to my law firm and saying, I'm going to be out for a month, probably disclosing why, but if not why, if I hadn't disclosed, there would be enough questions. And I was afraid of the law firm finding out about my alcohol and drug problem. So I refused to go away, and I went straight back to work the next week. I did agree to go to an outpatient detox 2 nights a week and to start going to 12-step meetings, but I was afraid of the stigma of coming clean on what happened at work. I came clean with everyone else in my life who I'd been hiding the worsening of my addiction from, but I wouldn't with work.
And the interesting thing is nowadays to find a 28-day opportunity is a huge challenge.
Yeah. I think, you know, there are more and more places to go, but I think there are challenges with insurance and how people are, you know, able to
Absolutely.
Make that happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's interesting because on some levels, while the need may or may not be greater, in a lot of ways, the available services are nowhere near what they need to be, nor is the ease with which to access those services anywhere near what it needs to be. We've been talking about your life, your drinking, your drug use, your career. Did you have a relationship in all of this? Are you in a relationship now?
I am actually married for the second time. My first marriage is recounted in the book. And I met my husband about a year and a half after getting sober. We're told in sobriety not to make any major changes in the first year. And if you're in a relationship that's not threatening your sobriety, to stay in that relationship. And if that's not abusive, obviously, or threatening to your sobriety. And if you're not in a relationship when you enter, don't date for a year. And I followed that. And it was about 18 months after I got sober that I met my now husband, who is, he drinks, but not anywhere near anything like me. He's a normal social drinker who can take it or leave it. If he has two drinks, it's a lot for him on a given night. And most nights he doesn't drink at all. So, you know, there came a point where when we were dating that I had to tell him, you know, obviously that I had this issue and that I was in recovery. And, you know, that was sort of a difficult thing that I wanted to, you know, time. It's not the first thing you blurt out when you meet somebody new.
Exactly.
But at the same time, it was something I felt like I needed to address, you know, before things got too far along.
How did he respond?
It was funny. He was, at first I said, we'd probably been out about five times. And the way I sort of opened it was, you know, I need to tell you about something. And he says, oh, no. And I said, well, I'm sure you've noticed that I don't drink alcohol. And he said, what? You don't? But that's how little alcohol means to him. Like, he hadn't even noticed that when we'd been out, I didn't drink.
Okay.
And I said, no, you know, because we had had some dates during the week or lunch dates or whatever where it wouldn't necessarily be obvious. But we had also been to dinner a few times. So he asked, he said, you know, was it bad? I said it was bad. I had a problem with alcohol and drugs, and I deal with it now, and I don't drink at all. And he said, okay, how long has it been? I said, it's been a year and a half. And he thought about it for a minute. And then he said, well, you'll be a cheap date. That was his answer.
So he was accepting of the fact that you had an issue and that you were working on it.
Yes. And I think, you know, I'm sure we didn't get married until 3 years after we met. And, you know, I think he had to be comfortable with the fact that, you know, I was on the right path with this and really committed to staying on the right path. And I think he's fully supportive of all of this and of all of the things that I've done in recovery. And when I say on a Saturday morning, I'm heading out because I need to go to a meeting, he's fully supportive. He is not reading the book. He knows the story. He does not need the details, and the details are fairly graphic. And so I'm fortunate in that sense that, you know, he is okay not only with supporting my sobriety, but supporting my sort of screaming from the rooftops about it.
And what about your colleagues? How are they responding to girl walks out of a bar?
Well, it was something I was very concerned about when I got my book contract that it was going to be coming out. You know, it wasn't something I spoke about broadly. I was sober when I joined this firm almost 12 years ago. So none of it takes place here. But I was, you know, obviously I don't want to say sensitive subject, but it's something that people aren't fully comfortable talking about all the time. And as I needed to tell management about, you know, the book coming out, people knew that I would go to my Thursday night writing workshop and I would go away on writing trips. And so they were used to that. And then everybody was excited when the book came out. And then I sort of said, well, now let me tell you what the book's about. And, you know, it's been amazing. The firm has been unbelievably supportive. And a huge piece of that, I think, is, you know, when I would start to tell the story and say, this is what the book's about. And, you know, I was high functioning and I you know, wasn't arrested, and this didn't happen, and that didn't happen, and I couldn't even get my story out before someone would say, you know, my cousin or my brother or my friend, everybody knows someone who has been touched by addiction, or either has suffered or is in recovery or is still suffering. So it really made me realize, you know, it's not, even though it's something that people are really hesitant to talk about, it's everywhere in some form. Everybody, I feel like so many people have been touched by it in one form or another. But I've been incredibly fortunate to have amazing support. I work in a wonderful place.
Which is wonderful. What about your parents and friends during that time? How have they responded?
Well, they were all sort of very much part of the process in the writing of the book. So my father passed away 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, and he was my hugest supporter. I had my family and my friends. The friends who are in the book that I write about are my true friends and the people I'm still friends with today, all of them. And I would run pages by them and say, you know, because like I say in the preface that, you know, memory is imperfect and memory under the influence is worse. So, you know, in trying to get things right, you know, I would recreate conversations, but I would make sure that the person I had the conversation with agreed with me. Is this how we talked about this? Does this sound right to you? Do you remember this? Am I getting this right? You know, some people wanted their names changed, which I did. And, you know, I think I really was surrounded by a lot of wonderful friends and family. So there's nobody who I'm sort of taking down in the book in any way. So they have been, you know, really great support to me through the whole process.
What would you say to those who are entering into high stress fields, perhaps just coming out of a degree program, maybe a lawyer, maybe a physician, but, you know, there's so many high stress jobs nowadays. What would you mm-hmm. say to them about the choice to turn to substances as a way to get through this day, this hour, this meeting?
I think a lot of it is sort of to pay attention to your behaviors, pay attention to your intentions and your around the substances you use, for instance. So, you know, maybe you're having that extra drink at night because you had a really stressful day and taking the edge off. Maybe you're trying to escape and you find yourself drinking more nights during the week than you used to. I think before, to the extent that it's possible, when those kinds of patterns, because by the time they're entering the profession, people have sort of either they're social drinkers or they're not, or either they're problem, you know, they're on the road possibly to being problem drinkers. And I think if you see changes in your behavior, question it. I looked at it as a solution. And I think if it's possible to not look at it as a solution, but look at it as a flag that, hey, something's wrong here and I have to figure out how to make myself happy or to make this job work for me or to take care of myself better, without it being about turning to a bottle of wine every night, that's what I should do. I mean, that's what I think I would say. I think my habits changed and I knew they were changing, but instead of saying, what should I be doing to address this? I've clearly got an issue with the life I'm living right now. And I don't want to bury it in the bottom of a bottle. I just buried it in the bottom of a bottle. So maybe somebody can make a different choice when they see those things starting to appear.
You mentioned earlier on in our conversation that you could conceivably drink a six-pack.
Sure.
At one sitting. And there are more than a fair number of people who will say, I'm not an alcoholic, I only drink beer.
Yes, that's true. And beer is alcohol. And, you know, to me, it sort of goes around, again, the intention. Are you drinking because you want to get out of your head? I don't care if it's beer, if it's wine, whatever it is. Or are you drinking in a social setting where you can take it or leave it, you know, or you like to have a couple beers once in a while because you like how they taste? To me, it's sort of, are you doing it as a solution to a problem, is one question. And another question is consequences. If you're only drinking beer, but the beer you're drinking means you're late to your job every day and you're starting to alienate your friends, then that's a problem. Then maybe you want to look at that. I would tell myself, you know, when you make crazy rationalizations, all these things, I would say to myself, you know, when I started drinking at lunch, I would say, well, you know, people in France drink at lunch, so there's really nothing wrong with that.
Right.
And then when I started drinking in the morning, which I swore I would never do, I literally said to myself, well, it's lunchtime in France, so people are drinking there and it's an okay time to drink.
Yeah, it is amazing the number of tales we can tell ourselves when, you know, on a lot of levels, we know we might be engaging in behavior that's at best risky and at worst life-threatening, perhaps life-ending.
Yes, yes. And it's hard, it is very hard in that moment to separate and say, I'm going to stand back from this and, you know, take a decision that I have to change something. I mean, it literally for me took me thinking I was going to die that morning to, you know, to actually be willing to change it. Everything else was, I'll do it tomorrow. I can get this under control. I can stop drinking in the morning. I just have to try harder. It's a very tough thing.
Well, not only the fear that you were going to die, but the realization that you didn't want to.
Yes.
Which was very different from, I'm just going to live my life drinking and doing cocaine.
Yes.
Lisa, I really want to thank you for joining us today and for being so candid about your experiences. Is there a website or a place that people can go to get more information?
Yes. If you're interested in more information on any of these things that I've talked about, articles and other things that I've done, please go to www.lisasmithauthor.com.
Okay, Lisa, L-I-S-A, Smith, author, A-U-T-H-O-R.com.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Thank you again very much, Lisa, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And I think that our listeners appreciate what you've had to say. So thank you again. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org, or downloading the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. To get in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And folks, I want to remind you, if it's unacceptable, well, then it's unacceptable. Take care.